It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hi, this is James Jokum, host of Web Comics Reviews and Interviews. Today, with Gordon Firemark, attorney. So sit back, relax, and let the Geek Fest begin.
Yes, I'm Gordon Firemark. Nice talking to you. I'm glad to be here.
Just real quick, what exactly do you do?
Well, I am an entertainment, media, and business law attorney. I've been in practice since 1992 here in Los Angeles, California. So I represent a lot of folks in the media industries, mostly independent film and television, and the folks that create the stuff that gets turned into film and television. So authors, novelists, journalists, and comic artists, and those kinds of folks.
Okay. This is definitely going to be an interesting... That means I don't have to translate a lot. That's cool. Well, I guess we'll start off with the fun one. Like, we're trying to do all sorts of weird stuff with WCRI, so... I guess the fun question is, and I know this is going to be a relatively simple one, I hope. If I do two different scripts, a comic book script and a movie script off the same property, is that two different entities as far as copyright goes or the same one?
Well, it sort of depends. If they've both sprung from a common idea, but they have different storylines, different arcs for the characters, for example, then I would treat them as separate. But if one sort of preceded the other, even though you were thinking of them as separate, the chances are the one that follows is what we call a derivative work based on the original. So one copyright for the first work, a new copyright for the second work, but it embodies the underlying material from the first.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, if I do a comic book script and I do a faithful adaptation, because obviously I'm the writer on both of them, that would be basically, that would still be counted as two different words, a derivative and originating?
Yeah, I mean, each iteration of a thing in whatever medium is considered a new work. So I wouldn't think of it as selling them separately to different parties because, if you were to make a film adaptation of your comic book or something like that, the film company that ultimately buys and wants to distribute it wants to know that you're not going to sell the comic book rights to some other film company, and then they end up with a competing film based on the same underlying material. But you as the only writer, it's sort of not a big issue until you start splitting off rights and selling it to people.
Right. I'm obviously not going to be doing anything video anytime soon. As far as something we tend to get into a lot is homages. What's the basic rule on that? I'm bringing this up because of the Superman Shazam thing way back in the 50s, obviously.
Right. So, there is no specific carve out in the law for an homage. The nature of that is to copy some of the elements of the original thing in order to either promote and pay respect to, or sometimes to make fun of. And when it's making fun, we would call it parody or satire, right?
Right.
I think the Shazam was kind of satirical look at the Superman character. And there was another one in the 70s or early 80s, the Greatest American Hero TV show. Got sued by the folks behind the Superman brand, and they lost because the court said, no, it's not substantially similar. It's not really a copy. It only has certain common elements. A caped superhero is not something that we are going to give blanket protection to, and it was different enough and funny enough and, really was a parody. So parody is a form of fair use, which is a sort of a carve out in the copyright law designed to protect creators' First Amendment free speech rights. So, if we say you can't ever copy anything, then we're limiting people's right to build on those things or to comment or criticize or parody them. And so the fair use exception came up in the law and now has been codified since the mid-70s into the copyright law itself and isn't going anywhere soon, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I just was curious because I'm looking at sort of there's sort of a difference between a straight homage versus a, if we're looking, I hate going straight comic book, but with DC and Marvel, for example, there's a lot of characters have some definite similarities between the two. Yeah. They were actually designed that way. The classic example, strangely enough, is Legion of Superheroes and the Imperial Guard. If we were really looking at it, we'd be looking at Superman and the 27 million different variations of that. Supreme, you know, even DC, even Marvel has their versions that are specifically making or doing a homage to Superman. Even though, of course, some of it has hit satire, but...
Yeah, so even if it's not satire, even if it is sort of an honoring, as you would do with an homage, the question that we deal with when we ask whether something is copyright infringement is it, well, did they have access to the original, and are the two things substantially similar to one another? That question of substantial similarity really is the turning point for a determination of whether it's a copy or not. Now, what we have to do, though, is exclude from that question of substantial similarity is any components or elements that are sort of essential to the genre, you know, kind of like I was saying, with a cape or a superhero that can fly or something like that. Those kinds of elements are what the copyright law views as sens a faire. Essentially, sort of, you can't have a car chase. you can't have a cop movie without a car chase. So we're not going to protect the car chase as a thing. Same thing with a superhero comic or cartoon or movie or whatever. We're going to keep those, I don't want to say generic, but those sort of commonplace standard things that have to show up in order to make this kind of story work.
The tropes.
Same place. Yeah, the tropes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to cover that because it's just one of those things that doesn't quite, I mean, I know that parody is covered under fair use. It's just when you start getting into some of the sillier stuff, it tends to get really weird really quick.
Well, you know, interestingly, parody is covered under fair use, but there are lots of other kinds of fair use. And an homage, like we've described, might very well be considered fair use because the purpose and character of that is to comment and congratulate or you know, praise the original thing. Similar in a way to the way a movie reviewer might review a movie and, of course, has to talk about the film in order to do so. So it's possible that an homage would be considered fair use as well. But it's going to be a case-by-case determination.
Definitely. Like I said, going back to Captain Marvel and Superman, for example, The case that basically killed the company. So, see, and of course, and I've done a lot of the copyright stuff in other interviews. I figure what I was going to say is actually take to a certain advantage of the fact you're also a business lawyer as well. How comfortable are you talking about the dreaded corporate veil?
The dreaded corporate veil. I'm delighted to talk about the corporate veil.
Again, going back to a lot of comics tend to be businesses. Obviously, we start looking at some of the, you know, obvious business practices that can help or hinder the comics. Exactly what is the corporate veil?
Well, the corporate veil is a reference to one of the benefits of forming a corporation or a limited liability company now has a similar concept to a corporate veil. So if you don't mind, I'm going to back up a little bit and give you the background on it. So when a person creates something artistic and puts it out into the world or does any kind of business without forming an entity, without, you know, doing the paperwork and getting things filed with the government and so on, that person is considered a sole proprietor, or if it's more than one person, they're considered partners. And that's fine as far as the managing the relationship between the partners or whatever. But when you come to dealing with liability questions and financial issues and so on, each partner or each owner of a business is liable for anything that happens in the business. And so if you did have a comic that had a copyright infringement or injured somebody's rights somehow, the person who created the comic and therefore is its owner would be responsible and liable for any money damages that might be incurred. When you form a corporation or limited liability company, you are essentially erecting a shield around the or between the company and its owners, so that the company remains liable. It's a separate person in the eyes of the law. So it's the company that would be liable for those injuries or damages, but the individual owners of the company, which might include shareholders if you've used the company as a financing vehicle, that shield protects those owners from liability for those kinds of things. So the real values of forming a company like a corporation or a limited liability company is that limitation on liability, the corporate veil, the street cred, of course, that you get from having Inc. or LLC after the name of your business, believe it or not, that's a thing. The ability to use the company's structure as a way of handling the management structure of things, defining the management structure of things. And then finally, the ability to use the sale of securities, sale of membership interests or shares to investors as a way of financing the operations of the company. And so the corporate veil is there to protect those shareholders, and that's why we love that protection.
Definitely. Breaking that down just a little bit. Right. I just had the great question, and it's like slipped away. I hate when that happens. The real quick version is that, so let's say if you get sued by somebody for doing a copyright law, that means that basically your company assets would be online and not your personal assets.
Generally speaking, yes. The owner of the hold on, I'll start over. Yes, generally the owner of the copyright in the subsequent work, the one that's alleged to be infringing, would be liable for any damage or harm or infringement or whatever that the work might cause. And so when you have the ownership of that work inside a company, it's the company that's responsible for that, rather than the individual artists who work for the company or who transferring ownership raises other concerns, but basically that's the thing. Oh. This is what happens when you have an office. Nobody ever calls me until Friday afternoon. all right. So I think I got enough of an answer out there. Do I need to follow it up at all?
Nah.
Okay.
Obviously, I'm basically looking for funding. Like, obviously, the LLC is actually going to help me as well, because it adds a little bit of prestige to the company.
Indeed, yes. The LLC entity is sort of the modern favorite because it's a little simpler to operate and, in many cases, cheaper to establish and run.
Okay. Are you familiar with crowdsourcing at all?
I am.
Okay. How would this translate over to if I was doing a Kickstarter?
I'm not sure that the question of the corporate entity really has much bearing on that. Whoever it is that owns the material and wants to develop it into something is certainly free to use a Kickstarter campaign or a similar kind of a crowdfunding platform as a tool to generating revenue for the company. The thing to remember is that there are two flavors of crowdfunding. The first being the donation-based, the Kickstarters and the Indiegogos of the world, where you're just, the person makes a contribution and might get some kind of a quid pro quo, a t-shirt, a copy of the comic book or whatever it is, but that's really it. They're not an investor. They're not expecting to see a return on that investment. If the thing blows up, they're not going to see anything more than the t-shirt they got. Then there is the investment crowdfunding, which is a relatively new phenomenon, and we haven't seen a lot of how it's working out for folks yet, but it is possible to go through certain crowdfunding platforms that will allow you to give those investors a piece of the action on the on the back end of the thing as it grows. And so that is pretty attractive because, you know, you can raise up to $1 million that way to fund a project like a comics project or a film or theater project or anything.
Yeah, because you're starting to see a lot of interesting, you're starting to see a lot of crossover, especially when we start looking at companies like Drunk Duck, that sort of thing. Drunk Duck is a webcomic site that basically is, for lack of a better term, is basically an aggregator.
Yeah.
It basically takes all these people, allows them, gives them a little bit of web space, and lets them basically do whatever they want with their webcomic within certain limitations.
Oh.
Basically, it's an online comic book lack of a better reference.
Yeah.
Drunk Duck is also, every once in a while, tries to step into actual film production. And I think I think they've tried it a couple of times, but they haven't really succeeded just yet.
Yeah. That's actually one of the things you want to watch out for as a creator and an owner of material, is that as you start doing business with these aggregators or putting your stuff on sites, that in the terms of service that you're putting it up there, you're not giving them rights that you're not, that you weren't aware you're giving. Like, for example, a right of first refusal to acquire film rights in something or something like that. I'm not familiar with Drunk Duck particularly, but I have seen some of these online film festivals, online contests and competitions where they sort of grab at certain rights that if you're not careful and reading things line for line, you might miss.
Okay. Sorry. I'm looking at the video and going, I definitely should have shaved this morning.
Nobody's going to see the video.
I hope so. Is there any general business advice you'd have for somebody doing a comic?
Well, you know, I think this is the same advice I give to many kinds of creators and artists. And that is that, yes, it's wonderful to be in the world of art and creating fun stuff that inspires and gets your juices flowing. But if you want to really make it and have a career in it, you have to think of yourself as being in business and having a business-like approach to things. And what that means is thinking about, should I form some kind of an entity to separate my personal from my business life? Should I register my copyrights and protect my trademarks? I think that's a very important component of things. And using contracts. When you work with a collaborator, you should have something in writing that lays out what the relationship is. You don't want to have, you know, start your company and then, you know, you put out five titles and on the fifth title, you've got a collaborator who now thinks he's a co-owner of the company, for example, something like that. So you want to make sure that you're thinking about the potential pitfalls and making sure you document things as you go. And good contracts make for good partners, frankly, good business relationships. So I don't think it's ever too soon to start thinking about the legal and business affairs aspects of things. You don't let it consume your life, but, you know, being mindful and taking the time to consider things, you know, every few months, is there anything I'm doing here that I should be thinking about? And of course, watching out, knowing the rules about when you portray or depict a real person, you don't want to step on anybody's toes with their right of privacy or their right of publicity, the right to use that. That's the right of a person's to control their name or likeness in commercial uses. And you certainly don't want to defame anybody. And that would be, you know, false damaging information, statements made about a person. So there have been cases involving comics actually that, portrayed real rock stars and stuff like that, and those rock stars weren't happy with the way they were depicted in the book for whatever reason, and sued and have won. It's gone both ways, so gotta be careful.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting copyright as far as Roman Eccles novels type goes. So
yeah.
I think one person actually was, they were able to point out they were actually mentioned indirectly and they were still able to sue successfully.
That's pretty unusual because most of the time just mentioning a person's name or even showing a picture of them, if it's in the context of an artistic work, in the creative context, not on the cover where you're using it to sell or market the branding, generally in that context, you're okay with mentioning a person's name. It's what we call a nominative use, and it's not implying any kind of endorsement or business relationship, so it's okay. But better to err on the safe, say again, side of caution and avoid that if you can, or get the permission if you need it.
In that specific case, it was a little bit more nuanced because basically it was a friend of a friend type situation. Everybody who was involved with it knew exactly what the reference was. And so once it was put in there, it was considered libelous. And again, context is king.
Right. And libel, you know, when it's a false statement that hurts somebody's reputation, that's a pretty good slam dunk. Doesn't have to do with their name or likeness so much as, you know, you've caused injury to their reputation.
It's also fun looking at the difference between libel and slanders, but we usually deal with just the one. So
You want me to cover that real quickly?
Go for it.
Okay. Well, so the difference between libel and slander is actually a fairly bright line we can draw in the sand. You know, a slander is a spoken word, generally a smaller audience. You know, one person stands on a little stage and talking to a few dozen people or something like that, or even just one-to-one. That's slander. Libel is the more serious version of that, where it's been somehow published or disseminated widely. If it's in electronic media, if it's on the web, if it's that kind of thing, it's definitely going to be considered libel, not slander. So that's really the distinction.
Yeah. Of course, we're going to deal with that. As creators, we deal with that because of comic book panels.
Yeah.
So we sort of have that fun situation where we have to watch what we're saying when we're ever in front of an audience, the slander part, versus whatever we're writing in our comics, which is the libel. So it gets fun, especially when you start dealing with Twitter. Comics has gotten a lot more interesting than it ever was. Going back to transformative work, what can I get away with as far as how far can I get away with if I have a plot that's basically the same as two different stories? Classic example here, obviously, would be Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, and I know this, you're going to love this reference, Roger Corman's Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, I hadn't heard that one. I was thinking of The Magnificent Seven, but...
Why would I go the obvious?
Right. it's a good point. You know, I mean, that's a situation where the same general storyline, plot line is there. So it is what we would consider a derivative work. And they're both in the film genre. So I would say it's probably not really going to be considered transformative in the way that maybe adapting it into making a painting or a...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Or a sculpture or something, that's transformative, taking it into a different medium and maybe even making a different message out of it. Transformative is one of the component analyses that we get into when we get into this question of, is it a fair use? Is it protected by First Amendment? This is this weird four-factor test that we have to evaluate each case on its own. And then transformativeness comes in and sort of permeates all four of the factors, and nobody really fully understands it. So
I agree, because the river works tend to be real common, because we can, even though we have to deal with the same basic tropes, we tend to basically put a different skin on it, so to speak. So, from a, it's the running joke of from a, from a role player's perspective, there's no difference between a rifle and a laser gun and a crossbow. They all do the same basic concept, which is doing damage at range.
Yeah. Just the number of hit points. For
right. Or in this case, the technology in use.
Yeah.
It's the same basic concept. It's just a different skin.
Indeed.
So, is there any actual key? Is there any examples of good difference between derivative works? As far as what the range of difference has to be, or basically what I'm saying is obvious, I couldn't do an exact copy of the Seven Samurai. Exactly how far would I have to change it in order to consider it basically a new work?
Well, it really isn't a question of how much do you have to change. It's because if you're copying something, then you're copying, even if you do then go and change it in a dramatic direction. If it's an entirely original work, then we don't have this conversation at all. But when the works appear to be somewhat similar, then we have to analyze also how much access did the alleged infringer have to the original work. And, you know, do we allow a jury or a judge to draw an inference that it was in fact copying and not some kind of independent creation or some other kind of protected free speech, or was what was taken so small and minor that it doesn't matter? We call that de minimis use. But so I would say it's not about whether you have to change it. It's about whether you're making a copy. If you have to ask, did I change it enough? The answer is probably no.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just pointing out because with Magnificent Seven, I think there actually was it was actually based off Seven Samurai, and actually there was actually the legal and all that was actually taken care of.
Yeah, contract.
As opposed to Battle Beyond the Stars, which was, we're going to basically have a farm boy go after these seven space warriors, grab them all together for the mutual defense against a local warlord.
So. Yeah. You know, the truth is we could probably find enough instances in historical fiction and, historical texts of similar stories about, you know, the assembly of a posse or the townspeople going after Dr. Frankenstein. You know, there are lots of situations where a group of warriors has been assembled or a group of leaders has been assembled to go out and rescue. It probably goes back to the Iliad and the Odyssey, even when you start to think about, you know, where those sort of fundamental common themes come from. But Kurosawa told the story a certain way, and The Magnificent Seven was very obviously an adaptation of that film. And so the producers were right to go and get the rights from him.
Okay. That's sort of a nice distinction on that. Basically looking at the fact there was enough similarity that they were actually worried enough about making sure they actually had the rights to it.
I suspect that it was actually, you know, from the get-go, they knew they were wanting to do an English language cowboy version of of the Seven Samurai.
Right. And the Seven Samurai is definitely a classic because you definitely see it keep popping up every so often. So, I mean, it's just something cool about, I mean, it's not just gathering your fellowship, so to speak. It's just, there is actually it's different.
Right.
So, sorry, you're answering me way too quickly. that's not a problem.
I'm a lawyer. I can talk on end without stop. So try to give you a chance to ask more questions.
That's fine. Like I said, that's one of the reasons I put in the talk as much as you want. There's usually something I'll miss somewhere along the line.
What's the format of your show? How long are most episodes?
About 45 minutes.
Okay.
So we got about 10, 15 minutes to play. Mm-hmm. I'm not too worried about it because there's still a little bit of extra stuff we can add in.
Yeah, sure.
And I basically always, like I said, don't worry about it. If we run short, we run short. If we run long, hey, cool. Mm-hmm. So are there any particular issues you see coming up as far as copyright or business type issues a lot that should be stamped out, so to speak?
Well, lately I think there's a lot of, lot of litigation or a lot of saber rattling anyway around these areas that probably fall under fair use or de minimis use. And I think that a lot of the big rights holders, the big studios and even the big comic book companies are really throwing their weight around and intimidating the little guy into capitulation rather than sort of allowing for a robust development of the art form by allowing for the smaller uses to go on. And, you know, so I don't, it's not really an issue to watch out for. It's just something to be aware of that I think, you know, if you're creating work that is relating to, paying homage to, or commenting on other work, this, the climate these days is let's attack first and we'll see if we can figure out fair use later. There have been some recent cases on dealing with YouTube, actually, that said that when copyright owners do a DMCA takedown, they have to first consider, could this be fair use, and at least make a good faith assessment so that they're not violating on the rights of the people who've posted the stuff that they're going to take down. That was the case you might have heard about where Universal Music, on behalf of Prince and his music, took down a video of a little kid dancing around. While the Prince song Let's Go Crazy was playing in the background. And after 9.5 years of litigation, the United States Supreme Court finally said, you know, copyright holders have to check into this question of fair use before they do these draconian takedown proceedings, or else they can end up paying the other side's legal fees. So, yeah, that's something to be mindful of on both sides of it. If you're on the receiving end of these things, of course, claim fair use and, you know, do your counter notification, get your thing put back up. But if you're on the owner end where you're trying to get something taken down, think hard about whether it really might be fair use or otherwise permissible use.
Yeah, a lot of what I've seen is basically it's done a lot more to protect the trademark more than anything else. Paramount's a pretty good stickler, for example. In fact, just a couple of years ago, they changed their mind on how they proceeded, but they basically took the fan had actually put together all the money in the Kickstarter and all that to put out a fan version of a Star Wars property or Star Trek property. I have to keep those properties different. Right. Paramount, we're dealing Star Trek. And ended up basically doing an actual cease and desist.
Yeah.
And then actually changed their mind on and actually decided to go ahead and finance the project.
Yeah, there have been a few of those kind of situations. There's also a case that's just wrapped up. I think it's just wrapped up dealing with both Paramount and Theodore Geisel's estate, Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, because a team of artists came up with a concept for a project called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. And it's a Star Trek version or telling of a story in the rhyming cadence of the Dr. Seuss material, a la, I don't remember what the actual title was now. Is it Oh, the Places You'll Go or something like that?
They were having fun with Green Egg and Ham, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe that's, well, there was a Green Eggs and Ham one also. But yeah, this one was a Star Trek and Dr. Seuss. So it was both Paramount and
Theodore Geisel,
the Geisel estate, and Paramount stepped away and said, no, we don't think this is terrible. You know, this is fine. It's a parody. But the creators of this thing seem to have prevailed in the litigation.
Admittedly, the one I would love to see fight it out would have been Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey, but that's me. You understand there's a connection there, right?
Yes, definitely. The 50 Shades, didn't it start as fan-created fiction based on the, tied to the original?
It was fanfic based on Twilight. Let's be open about it.
Yeah.
There was no disguising it. It was just straightforward. Hey, I'm doing this fanfic, and I'm just changing a lot of the elements.
Yeah, and even if you had copied certain character names, I don't think if just names would have necessarily been an infringement. This is one of those things where inspiration is very different from source material, being considered the source of a copy. So it is what it is.
Which, of course, brings up the fun. Just how important is trademark enforcement?
Well, you know, let's distinguish copyright and trademark for a minute. Your copyright protects the expression of ideas and facts in the particular form that an author has set it down on paper or affixed it into some form. So original works of authorship. Trademarks protect brands, that is, distinctive words or phrases or logos or symbols, those kinds of things that identify source and origin of a particular thing, in this case, a work. So I think it can be very important to protect your brand. I mean, you know, nobody's going to try to come out with another comic book series and call it, you know, Marvel this or Marvel that or DC that, because those companies have established very strong brands and protected them with solid trademark registration and so on. Likewise with brands like Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, you know, all the superhero names are trademarked as not just as literary characters, but also as, you know, for merchandise and those kinds of things. So I think if you create characters or a universe that is going to have value because of merchandise and beyond just the storytelling, it is definitely worth locking down that protection. And the sooner you do that, the better, because whether your plan is to exploit that stuff yourself or maybe you're going to get bought out in a few years, if you own the trademark, you have that registered, you're in a stronger position when it comes time for those negotiations.
Yeah. I just recently saw a really cute comic that basically, actually turns out it's not a really new comic. Basically what happened is that a couple of Marvel creators got together and decided to I can't remember who was it. I wonder how DC would feel if we did a female version of our characters, Wonder Man and Power Man. Keeping in mind, of course, DC has, well, Wonder Woman, obviously, as well as Power Girl.
Yeah.
It was Luke Cage dressed as a female version of himself.
Wow. So they actually did this, or this was something that they were considering?
Oh, when I'm talking comic in this case, I'm not talking the full 22 pages thing. I'm talking, they actually did one panel where they just simply said, you know, just a real quick, we would never, ever publish this.
Yeah. Oh, so they were just making fun of the idea of how trademarks and copyrights are used and wielded as swords in this business. Yeah.
Luca Cage, Power Girl. Wait a sec. So, and of course, Power Girl is, well, yeah, one of the more infamous DC characters because of the Window. I'm just curious, because is it possible to actually lose your trademark if you don't enforce it?
Yeah, great question. When you own a trademark, one of your obligations as a trademark owner is to keep using the mark in commerce. That is, you know, if you abandon it, eventually you lose the right to use it. You lose the right to stop others from using it. That usually takes about 5 years of no publication of anything and no remarketing of things. But also, if somebody else comes along and starts using your brand without your permission and you do nothing about it, you stand to lose it there too. That's viewed similarly to an abandonment. They'll say, look, this person isn't treating it like property, and so they shouldn't be given property rights in this thing. You shouldn't sit on your rights is really the bottom line here. We have an obligation to police these things, and sometimes that just means, hey, writing them a letter or sending a notice, hey, this is mine, what you're doing isn't okay, but if you give me a few dollars, or maybe not even money changing hands, you give me a little credit or something like that, I'll give you a license and you can have permission to do this if you're so inclined to do that. But it is incumbent on an owner to police their ownership of their property.
And of course, pointing out this, going back to the good old Roger Corman again, this of course was the reason for the original Fantastic Four movie that was never shown.
I wasn't aware of that.
Did you know that Roger Corman actually did have a Fantastic Four movie, or
No, I didn't.
One he did. It's available on YouTube. Highly recommended, especially if you think, yeah, it's definitely Roger Corman 110% doing a comic book movie.
Okay. Without permission, and so...
Oh, that's the fun part. He did it completely with permission.
Oh.
The entire point was that the company that currently that has held the rights to Fantastic Four is about to lose them, and they need to do something about that.
Ah.
So, what they did was they commissioned Roger Corman to do a version of the Fantastic Four.
Oh, so there was an iteration that kept the brand alive, so they could actually do something else with it, and... Were they anticipating that the Corman thing wouldn't take off and become so widely known that it's a peculiar set of facts, but interesting.
It's just the Corman movie was never actually put out. It was just done, just like you said, just for the sake of trademark.
So, was that one of George Romero's projects also? Did he work on that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
So, I just pointed out because with comics you have a lot of orphan works out there. In fact, there's actually a couple of websites that are point out characters that have actually gone into the public domain because of trademark and copyright issues.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit unusual to hear about things falling into, well, trademarks will fall into the public domain because, again, as you abandon them. Copyright, though, interestingly, doesn't expire until... Well, the modern approach is 70 years after the author of the work dies. So it lasts a good long time, and that creates this orphan works problem where if somebody hasn't registered their work with the government and sort of said, hey, here's where you find me if you want to go look for this stuff, it means that it makes it very hard if somebody does want to adapt or do a new edition of something that pre-existed. You can't track down the owners. You're not supposed to do it without permission, period. And so there's a move in the Copyright Office and the Congress to create a special category of these orphan works and set up a fund to collect the money that would normally be paid to the owners. But I don't think it has that much traction yet.
Yeah. Just for your own edification, you might look up a character by the name of, I want to say, Mr. Terror.
Okay.
Just because he's one of those characters that fell into public domain and he's actually had a couple of iterations in a couple of different comic books.
Oh. Was it created early on, in, like before 1975 or so?
Yeah, I think it was one of the original comic book characters back in the 40s.
Oh, okay, yeah. So under the old copyright law, the copyright would only begin to exist from the publication with proper copyright notice and or the registration of the work. So if an artist created something and put it out and didn't put notice on it and didn't register it, it was in the public domain very early, and so that's why you have certain items are, just out there in the public domain. But anything created since January of 1978 falls under this life plus 70 rule.
Yeah. Well, I just sort of point that out because there's also the issue, like you point out, that it wasn't used for it. Keep in mind, a lot of the old comic book companies died in the 1950s because of the Wortham incident. So, Seduction of the Innocent, worth looking into if you're into the comic book history, but anyway, a lot of comic book companies died, and because of that, a lot of their works ended up, nobody enforced the trademark on any of them. So.
Oh, that's interesting.
And because of that, you had a lot of characters from the 1940s and even the 1950s end up in the public domain.
Uh-huh.
So I've been debating doing a film based on Madame Fatal just because it would be fun. No, you want to talk comic book characters, the weird history. You're going to love this one. It's an actor who decided to take on the crime-fighting persona of an elderly woman. Mrs. Doubtfire with martial arts.
Wow.
And it's just, yeah.
That's wild. I like it. So that's the area where we might get into it. Is it transformative? because it's sort of poking fun at both the Mrs. Doubtfire kind of character and the martial arts genre. You know, Bruce Lee becomes Mrs. Doubtfire, or Mrs. Doubtfire becomes Bruce Lee, whatever it is. You know, that's neither a Bruce Lee movie nor a Mrs. Doubtfire. So we get into it. Yeah, it's very transformative. Just because it was inspired or flavored by some of those components doesn't necessarily mean it's substantially similar.
Right. All right. And I guess the obligatory, anything else that I might have missed you want to put in?
I think we've done a great job of covering the kinds of issues from a legal standpoint that creators of graphic novels and comic books ought to be thinking about. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And I definitely wanted to make sure we had the corporate veil in there. It's just one of those things that's come up a couple of times recently. So, yeah. All right. I guess the obligatory mandatory plug for yourself.
Well, you can find information about me at my website at firemark.com or on my YouTube channel, where I do a Q&A series called Asked and Answered. Go on over to firemark.tv to find that. And I have another site at gordonfiremark.com for all my other stuff if you're interested. And on most social media, gfiremark is the best way to find me.
Cool. And, of course, you can support WCRI at, patreon.com/twosparrows, T-W-O Sparrows.
Nice.
Thank you. And have a great day. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.